danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 182 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. From Baltimore, Maryland, I'm Andrew Brokus, joined by Carlos Welch in Portland, Oregon?
Yes, back in Portland.
Well, welcome. Well, I guess I can't really welcome you home if I'm not there, but I'm glad you made it back there safely.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here, and I'll be here. So today's the 9th, I believe, so I'll be here for like 9 more days, and then I'll be headed back to San Diego until the springtime.
And San Diego is primarily for Mike.
At Mike's place. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Nice. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I basically just came to Portland to work the first half of January, mm-hmm. so that I can get a check at the end of January. And so I'll be here. I'm going to work up until like the halfway point, and then I'm out of here.
And the work is substitute teaching.
Yes.
Which you seem to be enjoying.
I'm loving it, man. In fact, I was subbing at a school this week, and this was a school for kids with like severe development issue, mental developmental issues. Mm-hmm. Got mental developmental. And I'm not certified for that. But when you're a sub, you can basically just teach anything. It's glorified babysitting in general. And in this case, it's like even less because these kids have like, they're called parapros. For the people who aren't familiar with that, you may be because you've worked with teachers which are debate thing, but the parapros are basically like just teachers that are more focused on helping the kids that have the there's got to be a better way to say mental developmental. I'm gonna say SPED. That's what I would say at school, SPED. Mm-hmm. Which is like
special education,
abbreviation for special education. But then there's like different severities of it. Mm-hmm. And so this is like the most severe, like the kids can't talk, that type of thing.
Wow. Okay.
And so each of the kids have like their own little parapro that works with them. So when I walk in the sub, there's already like 4 adults in the room that really run the show. Mm-hmm. And I'm basically like their assistant. So that's even less babysitting on my part than normal. But I've been doing that this week, and they really like me. The staff really wants me to sub there often. And in fact, my point was the principal pulled me aside the other day and asked me if I wanted. Well, he's kind of a funny guy. He started off saying, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And I was like kind of taken aback by that question, but then before I could say anything else, he kind of like clarified and said, he basically asked me if I wanted like my own classroom at a school teaching those kind of kids. And I'm looking at him like, first of all, I'm so not qualified for that. And second, what I want to be when I grow up is a substitute teacher. I want to be able to come here, work at this school and love it for like a week or two and then go to San Diego for 2 months. And if I'm like the head teacher, I can't really do that.
Yeah.
So.
That was my first thought when you said that question, was like, I'm already what I want to be. I mean, for you.
Yeah. Yeah. And when I say that, I think people kind of like, look at me sideways when I say that, but the way it really, what it translates to is I only work when I only want to work when it's absolutely necessary. So it's less about the actual job and more about the flexibility of the job.
Yeah. Which I guess a lot of people are looking for security more so than flexibility, so that having like a permanent full-time position is, I guess he's used to that being seen as a plus.
Yes. Almost, I'll say, man, probably 30-40% of the schools I serve, and they try to give me a full-time job. And I'm like, no. And like, I'm like the only sub that's ever turned it down. Like, that's why most people do substitute teaching, yeah, is because they're looking for a full-time job. But no, this van that I'm sitting in right now, this is my security.
I really enjoy the idea of these principals like thinking that they're doing this great boon, like that you've just been waiting to get this offer, and then having this being like speechless when you turn them down.
Yeah, it's exactly like that every time. And then they start throwing other perks at me, like they try to, like, you know, I can remember I used to work for UGA, and one of the women that worked with me, her husband was he did something with computers. I guess he was like a web designer or something. But if Nate was here, he would be familiar with this term. I'd never heard of it at the time. Headhunters.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So she was telling me about the headhunters were constantly throwing jobs at her husband. And that whole concept just blew my mind. It's like people are like offering you job when you're not looking for them. And then you got other people, like my whole life, you know, my experience is people looking for jobs and not being able to get them.
Yeah.
So for like, you know, you're just minding your own business at your job, and all of a sudden, like, you know, everybody else is throwing you jobs too. So I always wonder what that feels like, and I guess I'm kind of experiencing a little bit of that now.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of like relationships too, where there's a lot of people looking, but only a few people who are like really in demand, and the people who are really in demand are, you know, there's people are looking for them even though they're already nominally taken.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. Kind of reminds me of the idea of needing experience to get a job, yeah, but not being able to get a job unless you have experience.
Yeah, that's it. Like once you're, and I mean, with hiring too, though, I think so much of it is about how difficult it is for employers to get rid of you once they have you, so that they're very reluctant to like take on an unknown quantity. But once you've like demonstrated yourself to be a viable employee elsewhere, then you sort of become a very valuable commodity.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
My understanding, too, with the teaching special ed specifically is that it at least used to be a thing that teachers did specifically to make themselves more hireable. Like that there used to be a dearth of people who were qualified to do it. And what some teachers had told me is that had sort of, it was a widely enough known strategy now that it didn't work that well. But for a while, that was a thing that teachers would do to increase their, I guess, prospects of finding employment was to get special ed qualification.
I haven't had experience with that, but I can kind of see that being a thing. Like even now, SPED teachers and also math teachers are in high demand. Like I'll kind of look at the Portland school systems hiring page every now and then just to see what opportunities are out there. Mm-hmm. And they're constantly looking for SPED people and math people. So for me to be a SPED math person, that's probably why they're constantly on me.
Yeah, that would make sense.
Yeah.
So what exactly are you doing when you're in the SPED classes?
Okay. So basically, I'll just like some of the things. So when I first started at this school, they have kids ranging from like kindergarten all the way up to high school. And I just found this out today while, you know, researching when I was at the school. In Oregon, if I understood it correctly, the students here can't drop out of school until they're 18. And in Georgia, that was 16. Mm. And I don't know what the standard is across the country?
I think 60 is more common.
Okay, okay. So 18 in Oregon for some reason. And so this school, the SPED school, has kids from kindergarten all the way up to 12th graders, including some kids that are either 17, 17 and a half, or maybe be 18. And I think with some of the SPED kids, they'll even keep them up to like 21, because like a lot of times their physical age doesn't match their mental age. Mm-hmm. And so I've been working with that full range of kids. And so the first day I was there, I was with the older kids. But it was kind of felt like an elementary classroom, like I read to a kid. And I had a kid, and this boy I think was like a junior, so I'm guessing he must be like 16 at the youngest, 16, 17, something like that. So I'm reading like a little children's book to him, and also having him to like point out certain of his sight words, that, you know, there's certain words on the page that he's responsible for like knowing by sight. Mm-hmm. So having him read those, I did a math worksheet with a kid that was basically just like totaling up menu items at KFC. And a lot of it with these kids is just like just restraining them physically, because they, like, sometimes they'll just like try to like run off. Like we went out for recess the other day. I had a fifth grader, I believe, and he doesn't talk, and he's kind of real, you know, kind of, you know, jerky movements and everything. And like, he'd be sitting at his desk, and it's like, these kids are smarter than you think. It's like, he'd be sitting at his desk, and somehow his parapro will get like distracted, and he'll just jump out of his seat and just take off running. And so he's like, tries to run out of the classroom. I had to like run and grab him. And when we went out for recess, you know, I was walking with him holding his hand, and he kind of like jerked away from me and like started running like towards the street when there was cars there. So I had to like grab him before he like ran out in front of a car, that type of thing. And I don't know, just the easiest way to say it is just like, you know, whatever's required of me at the time. Sometimes it's like teaching basic math. Sometimes it's reading a book. Sometimes it's like tying a shoe. Mm-hmm. So like, yeah, basically anything that they ask me to do.
Gotcha. Yeah, I had, when I was growing up, I had a next door neighbor who taught special education, and it was like, it was pretty common for her to come home with like bruises and stuff. You know, I don't know how much it was from people being deliberately violent and how much it was like what you're describing, you know, someone just tried to do something unsafe and you had to restrain them physically, and you know, they ended up getting hurt in the process.
Yeah, some of them are deliberate. There was one kid, and it's fascinating to me, because you show up for the sub and job. You don't know the background on these kids, and you're just kind of figuring things out as you go.
Yeah.
And there's one kid, like, these kids are, like, massive. Like, there's at least three kids in that room that are bigger than me. And one of them kind of, like, puts his hand up for a high five. And then when I go over to high five him, he, like, grabs my arm. So he kind of set me up. You know, I got a kick out of that. There's another kid, if I had to guess, he's probably like 6'2", 6'3", has to be at least 300 pounds, maybe more.
Wow.
And he comes in, and his favorite sentence is, "Fuck you, give me candy and toys."
Wow.
Yeah. And so, but he's a big one. Like, sometimes he'll get, I think he has schizophrenia, and sometimes he'll kind of get out of hand and like bang his hand on the desk. But then like, they kind of need, you know, my physical presence sometimes to kind of like get these kids in line, because they a lot of them will try to run over some of the smaller females.
Yeah.
Like the one day I wasn't there, they had a different sub, and it was like according to the parapros, is like a 90-year-old lady. And, you know, by the end of the day, she was just sitting at the desk in tears. Jeez. Because she couldn't really do anything to control these kids. They didn't really, they kind of took advantage of the fact that she wasn't able to physically restrain them. Mm-hmm. And at some point, the parapros just told her to, like, you know, and as nicely as they can, to, like, just get out of the way because you're not helping. And in fact, these kids can hurt you. Mm-hmm. Like, if they knock you down, you can easily break a hip or something.
Yeah, and then it's going to be like another thing they have to do.
Yeah, yeah. There's one boy that likes the headbutt, so I've dodged a couple of headbutts this week. But luckily, he wears like a soft helmet, so even if he catches you, it won't hurt. I'm assuming it won't hurt too bad, but somebody got bit. One of the parapros got bit on the shoulder yesterday by like a second grader. And he was really worried, but I don't know. I get a kick out of a lot of that stuff. Like, one of the things I miss most about teaching is breaking up fights. So I kind of miss the physicality sometimes. So I'm glad to be able to get a little bit of that on a temporary basis.
And all of your job offers just got rescinded.
But they need somebody who can take a headbutt.
Yeah, but that sounds like a really tough thing to just walk into with, like you said, without having any training. I mean, was it a surprise to you that you were even going to be doing this? Like, did you just show up at the school and they were like, hey, you're in special education today?
No, the whole school is spent. So I knew I was going to be doing it, but I never know to what degree. And so I was kind of afraid of it for years when I started subbing. But I want to say in the end of last year, I did a class that was less severe than these kids. At least most of the kids were. Like in the class I've been in this week with seven kids, there's probably like five of them that are nonverbal. And in the first class I did, it was probably like the opposite ratio where there was only two nonverbal kids out of a group of five. And I just loved it. It's like the usually if the kid can speak, they're probably like autistic, and autistic kids say the most interesting things I've ever heard in my life. So I subbed in a group. I subbed in a class that had a lot of speaking autistic kids, and I kind of like, you know, really fell in love with doing the SPED classes, and so I kind of like seek that out whenever it pops up on the computer when they're looking for teachers. And sometimes I get more than I expected. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I get less than I expected. Like sometimes I go to a school, it's a quote unquote spared class, and it's really just a lot of kids that don't really seem to have a lot of, I don't know, severe issues, but they have mostly like behavior issues. And so, yeah, I got tricks for like dealing with, you know, all different kinds of kids. Like, you know, I play mind games with them.
Yeah, my understanding is that's pretty common that kids get shunted into special education sometimes when they're just like too much for a teacher to handle, even if it's not really developmentally related.
Yes, that definitely happens a decent amount. And I'll say even those classes I can deal with, because when you teach, or in my experience, a lot of times when I've been in a regular class, there's 25 to 30 kids, and then there's maybe about four or five kids that are behavior issues. Mm-hmm. And that can be a difficult situation. And if I'm going to deal with those four or five kids, I'd rather just deal with only those four or five kids in a SPED class.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think, have you been on the show since we were in Las Vegas? I know you and I met up when I was in Portland, but I'm trying to think if we actually spoke to you on the air. I think we haven't.
I don't think so.
So that particular night that we met up, we had sort of talked about maybe going to that card room that's in Portland, and we didn't end up doing it. Have you played poker at all live in Oregon?
No, I haven't. And this is a result of Vegas. So if the listen, if we haven't done a podcast since then, the listeners may not know that I had probably one of the worst summers I could have imagined. And I'm just kind of over it with live poker for a while. And so I was, you know, you'll recall me saying that one of the draws to Portland, in addition to the summer, was the rake-free poker that they have here. Mm-hmm. But I just don't want to go and play live poker anymore. Like, especially, so this summer, I think I played 20 or 25 events or something like that, and bricked everything. And not only bricked them, I think I probably, like, close to stone bubble, but stone bubble maybe 5 or 6 tournaments out of 20.
Wow.
And including, and Nate would appreciate this, 3 of those were survivors, which are basically a satellite. And so I'll say I was like maybe 1 or 2 bust outs on average from 1 or 2 bust outs on average was the difference between the $0 that I got versus the $13,000 minimum I would have got had I just survived 1 or 2 more people. And so that was tough to deal with.
Yeah.
that was tough to deal with. There's no bubble like a satellite bubble.
Truth.
So I'm just like, every time I think about just going to a live poker table now, I was like, at least when I bubble stuff online, I got like, you know, 5 or 6 other tournaments going. And I don't know. I might be scarred for life with the live poker thing.
Yeah, I mean, the online stuff, just for a lot of reasons, doesn't hurt as much. I mean, if nothing else, you're just way less time invested in it. And you've been playing other things the entire time. So it doesn't feel like as much as riding on that one event the way it does with live poker.
Yes, yes. And so the one thing I've seen that they have around here is they do like $1,000 sit and go that they film and like broadcast it over the internet. That is interesting to me. So I'll probably do that one day. But the tournaments around here are generally pretty small, and the cash games are probably fine, but I'm not as into live cash as I am into tournaments anyway. So if there's a toss up between like playing online tournaments, which are always available, or going to play live cash, I'm going to choose the online tournaments every time.
And how have those been treating you?
Win rate wise, they've been outstanding, but so far the long run hasn't caught up to that yet. But you know, I've been playing primarily on Bovada, which is also the same player pools as Ignition, and I don't know what it is, but like over the last 6 months, it seems like those games have gotten softer, like where people are just basically just giving it away. I play money games that are tougher than these games, and this is even up to like, you know, $100 buy-ins.
Wow.
And so I've been able to kind of consistently get 25, 30 BB per 100 over like the last 6 months.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, but you know, it's just like I'm really good at winning the early flips, and struggle with the late flips.
Yeah, that's an important skill to work on.
yeah.
That's the problem with tournaments, is like the prize is often just running bad at higher stakes.
Exactly. I mean the games are so like I'm definitely not sticking to bankroll management like I used to, and it's primarily because I feel like I'm like in gold rush mode right now. Like they're giving it away in $50 tournaments, so even though I may not be probably rolled to play those, I'm gonna play them anyway, and I'm also gonna come up to Portland and work I'd rather like work all week and then take that money and just fire it in $50 tournaments than to like stick to $10 and $20 tournaments when the games definitely don't get tougher as you move up. In some ways, they kind of get softer. It's like there's more psycho gambling. Like I had a hand the other day, just for example, this was this past Sunday. We're like 100 bigs deep. There's like a limp under the gun. Somebody makes it 3X. Somebody else calls. And I'm in the big blind with ace-king offsuit, like 100 bigs deep. I just shove. The limper call, the first limper call with queen-six suited.
Wow.
And it's like, if they're going to give it away like that, then, you know, I'm going to come up here and work in the winter, which is something I said I wasn't going to do. And I'm going to fire higher than I should, because eventually ace-king is going to beat queen-six in that spot.
Yeah, it's got to happen eventually.
Yeah. So I'm keeping my fingers, you know, being a math guy, I'm keeping my fingers crossed that, you know, this whole law of large numbers isn't a fallacy.
I think some pretty smart people have double-checked that one.
Okay, good. There's this race going on between, you know, the long run catch it. Like, am I going to reach the long run before every penny I own is gone? And also before, like, you know, the school year runs out where I don't have the option to, like in the summer, I don't have an option to sub to kind of, like, you know, get more buy-ins.
So, but you did some summer school last summer.
I did do summer school last summer, and I said I wouldn't do that again.
That's right, you did.
But
really
this, yeah, this is... this could kind of like convince me to do. I hope it doesn't come to that, but if it does, I'd be willing to do summer school again for this, because this is just like free money. Like, it's unbelievable. So Briar, who is a mutual friend that the I don't know how much the listeners
know Briar, but his name,
they yeah. Okay. So Briar plays a little bit on ACR sometimes, and I was telling him, like, God, man, you have to play on Ignition. You have to play on Bovada. And he kind of seemed reluctant. Like, he almost didn't believe how soft those games were. But so I would just, like, send him hand histories. Like, look at the crazy shit these people are doing. And I'm just, like, every day I'm sending him, like, unbelievable hand histories. And he finally started playing on there. And then this past Sunday, he sent me a message and said, Bovada players hate money. I was like, yes, you finally get it, you know. So yeah, it's definitely the place to be.
Yeah, I was gonna say, when you were talking about bankroll, and it seems like you've picked up on this, but for people who are listening, I mean, your bankroll considerations are pretty different from what they were when poker was your only source of income. This, in terms of like how risk averse you need to be, or how, you know, if poker is your source of income, if you run out of money, that's a really big problem. But if you've got a way of like reloading your bankroll, I think a lot of the typical rules that you hear of playing, especially when you have a win rate as high as yours at higher stakes, you know, make sure you have 200 buy-ins for this particular thing in your bankroll before you play it. Like, that doesn't really apply to you, I think.
Right, I agree with that. And also the other side of that equation is the expense side, which I'm basically the best in the world at. I'm like the Phil Ivey of expenses here. So I can afford to lose more buy-ins than the average player on that end also.
Yeah, that makes sense. Have you been doing the sped subbing exclusively? Like, it seems like, I guess from some of your tweeting, I also kind of remember you talking about ending up in classes where you were pretty interested by the content, not just the students you're interacting with.
Yes. So when I first got back to Portland this time, I basically just look for whatever pops up. Like, the two things that I just really jump on are the sped classes and just any high school class. I try to avoid high school classes that have freshmen in it because they suck. But other than that, I'm either going to be in a sped class or I'm going to try to be in an upper level high school class. And one of them that I did, I think this might have been I can't remember if this was the end of last school year or the beginning of this school year, but I did a, I think, biology class when they talked about how basically the evolution of multi-cell organisms. Mm-hmm. Like, there's like some details to that story that I don't remember learning when I was in school. Maybe I did learn it, I just forgot. But there's definitely things I know I never learned. Like, last school year, I was really into this philosophy class that I subbed in, where they talked about the Milgram experiment. I definitely never heard of that until I subbed.
Called the prison experiment where the... well, at least allegedly, the results were like it was kind of like psychologically traumatizing for the guards.
Well, that was called the Stanford prison experiment. They're similar. The Milgram experiment was a basically a scientist in a lab coat telling one of the
shocking people.
Yes. So, just for the listeners. Basically, if some authority figure is telling you to, like, help another person learn by giving them, like, punitive, mild shocks every time they get a question wrong, and then, so it starts off with, like, I guess it's, like, static electricity, that level of shock, and it goes up a little more and more each time, and it gets to the point where it starts to feel dangerous. But the expert is telling you to keep going and you want to stop, but they just wanted to check and see how many people would actually disobey the expert. Mm-hmm. And very few people would. And that idea just kind of blew my mind, because from what I understand is they say that was how the Holocaust happened, is that, you know, for a lot of the Nazis or people, like some of the I guess lower or mid-level workers, basically their excuse was like, hey, I was just doing my job, just following orders. And so it blew my mind, like, we all look at that and we see evil and we say, oh, there's no way I would ever do that. And then this guy on an experiment said, like, you don't know what you're capable of when you have like an unreasonable level of respect for authority. So that, like, that blew me away. Like, that whole, like, that was so good. And I don't remember having any classes like that when I was in high school. So, yeah, I call it getting a reverse education. I mean, I call it reverse tuition. They're paying me to get an education.
Just while we're on those studies, I don't know if it was Nate or somebody, I think, shared some links. I hadn't heard this prior to them sharing that, but it seemed like maybe some doubt had been cast on how exactly those studies were. Where I forget some of the details, but do you remember reading this?
I do. I forget the details as well, but I do remember Nate providing an article that kind of... debunked some of the Milgram experiment.
And but the other important detail, at least in the Milgram one, is that the people weren't actually getting shocked, right? It was actors.
Yes.
And they were acting as though they were being... So, I mean, it's still, I think, equally traumatizing for the participants who believed that they were actually inflicting this pain on people. And I think part of the problem is, you know, if there are concerns about the way those experiments are conducted, contemporary ethical standards for conducting this kind of research would not allow you to do an experiment like this. So it's not the sort of thing that people can just go out and try to replicate. Like, someone couldn't just say, okay, well, if we didn't like the way Milgram did it, let's try doing it again. Like, it's not the sort of thing you'd be allowed to do today.
Now, they have repeated it. I want to say, like, Dateline did it one time, but it's a lot more milder now than they did it before, specifically for those reasons. And I think they have to have, like, a psychologist there during the debriefing period to make sure that people are okay when they leave. So yeah, it's definitely, I want to say the original one was done in the 50s, I believe. So yeah, times have changed since then.
Did you ever participate in studies when you were in college? This was a good like NICAST thing.
No, I did not do it in college. I didn't know it was an option. But when I mentioned that I used to work for the University of Georgia, and we had a food safety lab on the campus, and sometimes they would like pay me to participate in like test tasting, and that was probably the best job I've ever had in my life. It was just like I made like $10 an hour to eat like pork rinds made of peanuts. I remember that. It's just like different kinds of them, and like, you know, judge them based on the grittiness and the taste and the mouthfeel, all this kind of stuff. And so I was like, man, I wish I could do this all day, every day, but it was, they only did experiments occasionally. But I have done some marketing type stuff outside of school where, you know, they bring in a, I think it's called a focus group to like give their opinion on different advertising campaigns and stuff like that. And they paid pretty good. Like I can remember once making like $100 for like a 3-hour focus group or something. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, I apparently participated in one of those as a baby. Like my mom brought me into toys, and I just like, you know, they watched me playing with toys for a while, and then we got to like keep all the toys at the end of the thing.
That's awesome. That's, man, like I would do that kind of stuff for a living. If I had access, I mean, why wouldn't you? If I had access to it, if I knew, like they're always looking for like different demographics, so you got to make sure that you fit whatever they're looking for. Mm-hmm. But when I was in Atlanta, there was an organization that did it pretty often. I want to say like once a month. In fact, another mutual friend, Pie Farmer, who I'm sure the listeners have heard of, he was the first one to kind of tell me about it. Before I left Atlanta, that was probably a decent percentage of my income was going and getting paid to eat or getting paid to like look at, you know, magazine ads and tell them what sucked and what didn't. So yeah, that was great.
Yeah, well, except for my experience as a baby, I've not done the focus group thing. I did actually once get paid to watch pornography, which was started as the best job that I ever had and turned into one of the worst jobs that I've ever had, because it was like a 2-part study. And this is actually, I'd done a bunch of these, I've done some like little studies at the University of Chicago, because the economics department there is, I guess, like a very world-class economics department there. So they do a lot of studies also. It's mostly like either the psychology department or the economics department. We're doing a lot of like how people make decisions sort of studies. And those were usually like one-off. You know, you get $5 or $10 and you would do 5 or 10 minutes there. So it was like a pretty good hourly rate to get those, but it wasn't a lot of money in absolute terms. But there was one study that it was a much longer study, but I think it paid like $300, which was a pretty big deal. The thing was, you were supposed to sign up for the study with your boyfriend or girlfriend. And my girlfriend did not go to the University of Chicago. So I had another friend who also, a female friend, who participated in a lot of these studies. And we just lied and said that we were in a relationship. And participated in this study, which involved, first it involved watching really boring movies. So they hook you up to all these like electrodes and things, and they put like gauze in your armpits and other places to like, so, you know, they're measuring like skin conductivity and temperature, and they're collecting your sweat was the main thing. So this study had to do with I think it was about pheromones or something along those lines, which is why they wanted it someone that you were like sexually attracted to. So what they're ultimately testing is whether your partner responds more to your your sweat when you're sexually aroused, as opposed to like someone else's sweat, and if they can distinguish between your sweat when you're sexually aroused versus your sweat when you're bored or when you're scared or whatever else. So we would watch clips first, like just the most boring shit you can imagine for like 20 minutes to establish a baseline. Just I don't even remember what it was. Like, I've blocked out how bad it was, but it was right. I mean, just like having to sit, and you know, this is like pre-phone, not that they'd probably let you use your phone anyway, because the whole idea is you're supposed to be bored, but it's actually really hard to sit for like 20 minutes and just watch these like wretchedly boring films. So you have to do that first so they get a baseline, and then, you know, you watch, one day it was clips from an action movie, one day it was clips from a horror movie, and one day it was clips from pornography, and they're collecting all this sweat. So getting paid to watch movies, great. Obviously the second part of this study involves sniffing sweat.
Oh my god.
So it's both kind of gross but also just very boring. You know, you go in for these like hour and a half sessions, and all you're doing is they're just giving you like test tubes with gauze in them, and you have to rate them, like, which one smells most like a person who is sexually aroused, which one do you think the person is least sexually aroused, where do you think the person is scared, and you just like, which one smells better or worse, and you're just like putting these cups in order for like an hour and a half of sniffing other people's sweat.
That sounded great in the beginning. I don't know if that's worth $300.
It didn't feel like it by the end. I mean, I needed the money badly enough in college that it probably was, but yeah, I dreaded going to those subsequent sessions.
Oh god, I could kind of like, I can smell it now. you probably still remember some of those smells. God, that's bad.
Honestly, yeah. The smells really were not the bad part. It was just the boredom. I mean, it was just such a tedious task. I mean, it didn't help that it was this kind of unpleasant task, but like, I'm not actually that bothered by that. Like, not a lot of things really repulse me. I don't mind smelling a thing that like is kind of gross. That like, that by itself wouldn't bug me that much. Mostly it was just really boring.
Gotcha. Yeah. That's how I feel about live poker. It's like smelling sweat.
Well, I do have a hand or two from live poker I'd be interested to discuss with you, if you can tolerate that much.
Yes. Only $300.
So this actually was from a $300 tournament. They've been doing this thing at Maryland Live that they're calling the Maryland State Poker Championships, which sounds very, dignified or whatever. It was actually, they're pretty small fields. Like, this one that I played yesterday was 77 players, and most of the actual best players in Maryland are in the Bahamas right now. So I don't think it's really, in any meaningful sense of the term, the Maryland State Poker Championships, but that's entirely an exercise in branding.
This sounds like something that will be done in a booth at a local carnival. Yeah, this isn't like, you know, you're not getting a bracelet for this.
But they do have some different formats than what, like, there was even a heads up tournament yesterday. I ended up doing well enough in the 6-max that I didn't, I wasn't available to play the heads up, but this one that I played yesterday was a 6-max. They ended up getting only 77 players. And throughout the, like, until we got down to the final two tables, where I think I had the worst table draw because I had two decent players on my immediate left, but prior to that, like, every single table was just soft as a baby's bottom. Like, it was pretty unreal. Even for, I mean, it's not super high stakes, but, I mean, the people were just real, real not good at poker.
Yeah.
And the weird thing, though, was I actually accumulated most of my chips through bluff catching, which is not how I typically advise people to approach these things or to approach live poker in general. Like, I think there's a lot of money to be made from value betting, obviously, or just, you know, when you get good hands, you sort of expect to win a lot with them. You know, we've discussed on the show before, and I think there's something to it as well, that there's also actually a fair amount of money to be made through fold equity. Like, you get a lot of people who play too many hands on early streets, and it might seem kind of counterintuitive to say that, well, you can both make a lot of money value betting and make a lot of money bluffing, but I mean, I think it's true, and it's just because, as Ed Miller would have it, you know, the base of their pyramids is too wide. Like, they're just playing too many bad hands out of the gate, and even if they fold a lot of those bad hands, they still end up calling down with a lot of them also, and especially if you can predict they're going to call this much and fold for this much. Like, you really can make money both from making them fold and from making them call.
Right, with sizing.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, yeah.
But my experience has been, and I mean, you've played more of these smaller stakes. I know you don't like them, but my experience has been you don't. I mean, there's certain spots where people, will bluff too much, or, you know, so certain players certainly will bluff too much. But in general, my advice to people is, like, you don't really make money bluff catching in these things. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, for small stakes, live tournaments, I would definitely say that's true.
So there were a couple of hands yesterday that ended up, actually, give me 1 second to make sure I pull up the accurate details on these. I did take the notes. Alright, so here's the first of these. And this one, the villain in this hand very rarely folded pre-flop. Like, he had definitely shown down 7-deuce offsuit after calling a raise from the small blind. So, I actually think 7-deuce, like, there were times when he folded pre-flop, so I think he actually had, like, a fondness for 7-deuce. I think he actually enjoyed beating people with 7-deuce. He had actually showed me a bluff with 7-deuce earlier in the day and, like, seemed to take particular joy in, like, beating me with 7-deuce specifically. So I think that was, like, part of the fun for him, was knowing that it was, like, such a bad hand and he was winning with it.
Yeah, I know the type.
So we're at the 500, 1,000, this is big blind ante, so 500, 1,000, 1,000. I have 53K. This player in question covers me by quite a bit. The one calling the raise is a 7-2 off, naturally. he's in the big blind. I have ace-queen offsuit on the button. Actually, let me just ask you right now, like, what would your preflop raise be in this situation? Like, knowing you've got this guy who is just, like, very loose pre, and, like, pretty sticky after the flop as well.
So it folds around to you on the button?
Yeah, me on the button. Small blind is pretty tight.
Okay, so if the small blind is pretty tight, it's going to be pretty big card heavy. And as Tommy Angelo would say, I would be waiting for straighters. So, you know, anything that can make a straight, especially if it's two big cards, or even, like, just two medium cards. So, like, the bottom of my opening range here is probably going to be something like queen eight off, something like that, maybe. Mm-hmm.
But how much are you going to raise the same amount with every hand? Are you going to do anything different when you have ace queen? Like, I think there's definitely room to be very exploitive, but I don't know if we want to be exploitive in this way. I'm curious whether that's something you would do.
This definitely reminds me a little bit of what's happening on Bovada right now, And so what I've been doing, like, there's multiple guys like this on the tables at Bovada, and so it's a nightmare when you're in early position. And so one thing that I've been doing to kind of counteract it when I'm in early position is using something that we talked about during the Coach and Carlos podcast series that is available at midcast.com, I believe. I would limp in early position because there's usually, like, a guy that will, like, raise.
Yeah, they don't free bet very much, but they will raise limps.
Right, and so I'm limp re-raising, like, massive, just to kind of, like, get a heads up if possible, or at least three-handed, and often with a decent amount of dead money in the pot. So that's how I kind of deal with these super sticky players from early. And then on Bovada and late position, I raise bigger. But not necessarily in a situation like this where I'm on the button and the small blind isn't like that. For example, if you told me that this character was in the small blind and somebody else was in the big blind, I may make it like 5x here, 6x, something like just massive. Because I want to try to either convince the small blind to fold and either just take it down or play against the big blind. Or if the small blind is going to call, I don't want the big blind to feel committed to call because he's getting, like, pot odds. Right. I definitely want to try to get this heads up against one of them, but I don't think it's there in this case because the target is in the big blind. So this is a spot where if I'm confident that the small blind is going to fold a decent amount, I can see myself going like 3x here. And if you switch those two seats between the big blind and the small blind, I may go 6x.
And let's say that you had 6-5 suited. Would you also 3x that? Would you not open it at all? Open limp?
With that hand, I think I like open limping with a hand like that because those type of hands benefit so much from high SPRs post-flop. And if I don't, and they also is not as much of a disaster to go three ways with a hand like that. So yeah, I can see limping or maybe min raising at the most with a hand like that, and I definitely don't mind being face up against these people because I don't think they're paying attention.
Yeah, I was doing a little bit of that. I wasn't anything real extreme. I wasn't like 7xing it, which I think helps because like, people will notice if you make a really huge raise. But if you just, you know, sometimes you're making it 2,000, sometimes you're making it 3,000, I don't think these guys are reading that much into it, nor do I really mind if they do. Like, you still want fold equity a lot when you have ace queen. So if they're, the way they look at it is just like, oh, you probably have a good hand here. Like, there's going to be plenty of flops where I miss with ace queen and want to represent that I have a good hand. I'm relatively happy to get pre-flop folds. Like, I don't really mind them knowing that I have a good hand when I have ace queen.
Right, right.
So I do make it, I make it 3K on the button. The big blind calls, which is quite predictable.
Yep.
The flop is 10-9-7 with two clubs, and I have the ace of clubs in my hand. He checks. Is this a, I guess it matters a little bit. Oh, I mean, this is really just going to put my finger on the scale. I think he is pretty check-raisy and pretty, has a pretty strong tendency to overvalue hands. Like, he's the sort of person who will check-raise here if he has, like, queen 9 or, like, king 7, just because, like, he has a pair and he wants to protect it or something. So I think against a player with that, like, this is a flop that I'm kind of inclined to check anyway, and a hand that I'm kind of inclined to check anyway, because it is like it's a board that a lot of people will check raise, and it's, you have a hand where you really want to see the next card. Like, you don't have a lot on the flop, but there's a lot of good turn cards, and I think this is like a, just as a default, like, I'll often check this hand on this flop, even button versus big blind, but especially against a player who I think is check raise happy, this I think is a pretty clear check.
I agree with that.
So I check back. The turn is the four of clubs. He bets 6K, so I have a nut flush draw now. He bets 6K. Mm-hmm. I call. I really don't have a sense of like how much he's going to bluff in this situation. I definitely think he'll bet like any pair. I mean, he's just going to bet if he thinks he's good. I definitely believe he'll do some bluffing here, but I don't know like what his standards will be. Does he have to have a club in his hand? Does he have to have a draw of some sort? Is he just going to fire with absolutely anything? You know, I'm not entirely sure about all of that, but I mean, regardless, this is a pretty clear call. Then the river is an offsuit 9. So final board is 10-9-7-4-9 with three clubs. So two clubs on the flop, a third one comes on the turn, but never a fourth one. So 10-9-7-4-9 is the board. I have ace queen with the ace of clubs, and he bets 13K into what's now 12-18, like a 19 or 20K pot.
So yeah. This is an interesting spot because usually when that second card pairs, that's going to be good for the pre-flop caller's range. But I think that kind of flips when you decide not to bet the flop.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you necessarily have more nines in him, but you definitely have more nines in your range than you would have had you decided to bet the flop.
Although, honestly, against this guy, like, I'm betting, you know, I'm going to bet a hand like queen 9 on the flop because he's going to call with a lot of worse hands, and he's like, I'm going to be comfortable calling a check raise also. So I actually think I would have bet a lot of nines against him, but I also don't think he's thinking a whole lot about my range.
Okay. Yeah, see, these type of spots are so difficult against the type of people who aren't thinking about your raise, because you think about the quote unquote correct play, which you're supposed to do, but then it's like, I can never remember this phrase. It's like playing Mozart to a cow. It's probably Beethoven. Is it Beethoven, right? It's one of the two. So, like, my first thought is, like, okay, you have the nut flesh blocker. And, you know, you have the cap range, so this 9 should be better for your range. And so, like, but maybe none of that shit matters against a caller station. Now, so that those are, like, arguments not to bluff the guy. But now our hand may actually just be a pretty good bluff catcher if we think that he's over bluffing in these type of spots. So,
or even if he's bluffing optimally, like having the ace of clubs in your hand is a pretty big deal bluff catching wise, or even if we were not capable of making any assumption about his bluffing strategy one way or the other, I would say like having the ace of clubs in your hand is a pretty strong argument for calling.
Especially given that you said that you would bet nines on the flop. So we don't have those. I'm assuming you're betting a 10. So
yeah, we pretty don't, capped after checking back.
Yeah, yeah.
And this we is don't arguably have a better bluff catching hand than like pocket threes would be.
Right, right. Because we block so much of his value range and unblock some of his bluffs. Do you read anything into his turn sizing? Like, that was almost pot?
That's a good question. No, I think he had a tendency, to, especially when like there's a lot of draws on the board and stuff, I don't think it was too surprising that he chose that amount. I think there's a lot of different kinds of hands I could see him doing that with.
And what about river sizing, where he's like, he's betting a smaller percentage of the pot now than he did on the turn.
Yeah, I'm less confident about that. I do think a lot of people are not thinking in terms of percentage of the pot. They're just thinking about,
right,
like, especially for multiple barrels, they tend to just kind of double whatever they did on the previous street, which is pretty close to,
yeah,
you know, 6,000 to 13. I don't think he was thinking about, you know, fractions of the pot. I think he was kind of like, I want to bet substantially more than I did on the previous street. Double, plus a little bit.
Right. Right, right. So what I would say about this situation is I don't really have confidence that we could get this guy off of a 10. Obviously, we're not getting him off of a 9. Tell me again, what was the river?
The river was a 9.
Okay, so what was the turn?
The turn was the 4 of clubs. So 10, okay, 9, so 7, 4, 9 in support.
That doesn't matter. So basically, any pair that he's betting like this with, he's not folding to a raise, will be,
yeah,
my,
yeah,
guess.
I didn't really consider, I mean, I you know, I considered it in the way that we're doing now, but I don't think there's much of a guess.
Right, not seriously. Yeah, and so, like you said, this is a pretty good bluff catcher for the reasons already given. So, yeah, I think I'll call here.
Yeah, so I was leaning towards calling. Again, it's one of those like wide base of the pyramid things. So, like, I just know he's calling with so many hands pre-flop, and then you start thinking about, like, well, once you check back the flop, I mean, it doesn't take a genius to think that's kind of weak on this flop. Like, people don't really slow play this board. So it was pretty easy for him to, like, fire the turn with anything, and then, like, he gets to the river, he's got no way of winning the pot if he checks. Like, it's pretty easy to imagine people over-bluffing in this situation if you know that they're way too wide pre-flop. So I was already like kind of inclined towards calling, but I did take my time anyway, just because I pretty strongly feel like if I never, like, if I could just go back through my poker history and like erase every remotely close river call that I ever made, I'd be a lot better off. Like,
Breyer and I just had this conversation this past weekend. Yep.
Yeah, so I mean, I did take my time, and then the thing that really solidified it for me was when I picked up my calling chips, which I was still, you know, I wasn't necessarily putting them in the pot, but I'm, you know, counting out chips to call with. So I've been sitting still for a long time thinking, and then when I did start handling chips, he pretty aggressively, like, made as, it wasn't quite like the thing that people do where they're pretending they're about to turn their cards over, but he did like make a move towards his cards and like look at them and just did a few behaviors, which from reading Zach Elwood's books, and maybe yep. I would have figured this out on my own, but is like, it's discouraging you from calling. Like, if he wants a call, he's not going to start moving when you're about to call. Like, he's just going to, like, stay still because you're already going in the direction he wants you to be going. So he's going to be afraid of, like, deterring you from that. That behavior, if anything, is an attempt to deter you from calling, where he's like, oh, it looks like you're calling. Let me see if I can, like, shake things up. But it's almost a free roll at that point. Like, if you are going to call, like, if you're about to call and he can somehow stop you from doing it, he has nothing to lose. Even if it, like, makes it obvious that he's bluffing to 90% of players, like, if I'm going to call anyway, then there's really no downside to him for doing that. But that definitely solidified it in my mind when he did that behavior. I was like, okay, that's got to be a bluff. And in fact, he did right. have ace three with the three of clubs.
Okay, now this is the one part of live poker I do miss. It's like, you know, you slightly move towards the chips and you just set off this cascade and dog and pony show where the guy's just like, you know, without using words, begging you to fold. I'm begging you, yeah. Begging you. And so, yeah, that part, I can't get that fixed online. I do miss that.
The second hand involves kind of similar physical behavior, and I'll spare you some of the details because they're less interesting. But basically, I had pocket nines, a guy who was relatively new to the table but had already acted out of turn at least once, open limped, and it didn't end up being any kind of like angle or anything. Like, he just didn't know when the action was on him, or was, I don't know what the reason was, but it wasn't, you know, he wasn't like up to something when he checked out a turn on a previous occasion. He open limped like either the cutoff or the button, and the small blind called, and I had nines in the big blind. I made a pretty big rate, probably like 7x or something in this situation, and both cutoff and small blind called. The flop was 8-7-5. I bet like half the pot. Cutoff called. Turn was a 4, so now 4-5-8-7, and I have pocket nines. I check. He pretty quickly bet a large amount, like 60% of the pot or so, and I took a long time before calling. And then on the river, like basically as soon as the river card was turned over, he just went all in. Like before I checked, he just like went all in, which I think you sometimes see this behavior on early streets when people are nervous and actually have a strong hand but they're afraid of getting drawn out, or they just want the hand to be over. So like, you'll see this if, you know, someone has pocket aces and they 3-bet, or even if they 4-bet pre-flop, and then they're just like, they're so excited and they're just like all in, you know, and they might out of position on the flop when they have a strong hand. On the river, though, I think it's pretty different. I think, like, on the river, because then, like, a lot of those people don't want to get called. Even when they have aces, like, they don't want to get called. They just want you to go away so they can, like, take the pot. And, like, what they're really afraid of is getting drawn out on. On the river, that's, you know, there's no getting drawn out on. So any anxiety that people would have is like, out the window. And he either has a six or he doesn't when he's taking this line. And if he does have a six on the river, he wants to get called. He may or may not want to get called on previous streets. There wasn't like a flush draw or anything, so I don't think he had a lot to worry about. But on the river, it's just, you know, if he's shoving, he wants to be called. And I think he's going to be more careful about not telegraphing that he wants to shove that badly.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure someone is listening to this and like has seen someone actually have it in this situation, but that just, it just felt very unlikely to me that he was going to have it when he couldn't control. And, you know, I considered the possibility that this was some sort of like angle, but because I had seen him act out of turn on several, or, you know, I think it was more than one, but, you know, at least one previous occasion that seemed pretty genuine, I think he was just pretty like inexperienced. And whether or not, like, I don't know if he was doing this deliberately to try to look strong, or I think he was honestly just this, I don't know if it was nervous about pulling the bluff or was subconsciously trying to look strong. I don't really think it was an act, but he might have like subconsciously been trying to look strong or eager to, you know, to bet all in as quickly as he could. But I called on that basis, and he just had absolutely, he had like queen 10 offsuit or something. He didn't have any coordination with the flop. I don't know why he got as far in the hand as he did, but
I was thinking the same thing about the ace three from the last hand. It's like, do they not, I guess they don't have any standards for what they choose to bluff with.
Yeah, it actually kind of made me wonder, like, he might end up bluffing with a better hand. Like, it's not impossible he has, like, pocket fives, you know, that he plays the same way.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. People, I had a tweet not too long ago that somebody that people really enjoy, probably won't be able to remember it now, but it was something along the lines of nothing sucks worse than folding the second nuts because your opponent inadvertently turn the third nuts into a bluff.
Yeah.
Like, I've definitely fallen victim to people overvaluing hands in certain spots. But I, actually, you know what, now that I think about it, it has nothing to do with this. We're talking about bluff catching, and I think I just kind of, like, flip that on his head, so
well, never mind. I have a story from Maryland Live about that too, but yeah, it is. I mean, so I think, like, calling here with king queen with the king of clubs would be much worse than calling with ace queen with the ace of clubs, because there is the possibility that he, I mean, I think this would be a pretty bad time. I mean, sometimes, like, having enough flush blocker is a really good time to bluff. I don't think this is one of those times. Like, I think he has enough showdown value with ace high that he shouldn't be bluffing all that much with it, but I wouldn't rule it out, which definitely makes calling with king queen a lot less appealing than calling with ace queen. And yeah, as it turned out, he was bluffing with ace three. So
yeah, I guess what I'm thinking of, there was a time where I check raised the river with the second nut flush for value, and the guy came over top of me with the third nut flush. Yeah. and I had to fold. But see, the good thing about Bovada is you can see all the old cards 24 hours after the tournament end, and I'm just looking at it like,
oh, God. I had a guy proudly show it to me. Like, I think I had 9-7, and the flop was 8-6-5, and I, like, check-raised him pretty big, and he called, and then the turn paired the board, and I was like, oh, that's not great. And I bet, and he raised, and I thought about it. No, this must have been on the river, because there was a four-card straight on the turn. That's what it was. It was 4-5-6-8 was the board on the turn, and I check-raised him pretty big, or maybe even three-bet him. I think that was, yeah, I think I, like, it was, like, bet raised my three-bet with 9-7, and then the turn paired the board, and I was like, oh, crap, that's real bad. I think he just always has either a straight or a full house draw after he calls the three bet. So I was like, well, I guess I just bet to get called by the straights and fold if he raises. So I bet and he raised, and I was like, ugh. And I, like, thought for it was a pretty small raise too. And I thought for a long time, and I eventually folded it. And then he, like, just in kind of a, like, don't worry, buddy, I had it sort of, like showed me, probably showed me a seven. It was like, don't worry, you made a good fold. And I was like, no!
That's the worst when they think they're doing you a favor.
Yeah, he was trying to be so nice about it. It was, like, the worst thing he could have done.
Yeah, that's exactly the situation I mean. Like, God, it's just so brutal. Like, you know, I almost want them to be at least somewhat competent to not, you know, inadvertently outplay me in those type of situations. Like, you know, just have basic levels of understanding of certain, or at least, like, how, I'm just disgusted by it.
Well, thanks. It was good to talk to you about those. And the playing some more. There's a 500 tomorrow. I think that's just nine-handed. It would be nice if it's eight-handed, but I don't think it is. And then the main event is this weekend, which is 11, so that should be good. And again, so, a lot of Maryland's best poker players are not in Maryland right now, so it's a nice time to be one of the better Maryland poker players who did not go to the Bahamas.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, man. If you win this main event, I think there's a chance you can...
Oh, I'm definitely going to call myself Maryland's best poker player. Absolutely.
Like, you probably get a t-shirt instead of any kind of trophy for this thing.
I was ready. I think there are trophies, actually.
Oh, cool.
I was ready to dub myself Maryland's best six max player after beating 76 other players, you know, 70 of whom were not in the top 500 best six max players in Maryland.
Yeah. It sounds like a pretty cool, anytime, I mean, poker series in general are great. Can't wait to rail you in Vegas.
So. I'm looking forward to it, too. I guess I probably won't get a chance to see you before then, but you never know.
Yeah. I'm trying to think. So, there's some chance, depending on when it happens, there's some chance I go to Run It Up Reno. Because I want to say that it's often, I think last year they had it during the end of March, which is spring break in Portland, so I don't have anything to do that week anyway. And I never really cared before because I once tried to find out how much the tournaments were raked, and I wasn't able to find the information online. Mm-hmm. So I said, screw it. But then I saw that they have a live stream. And now I don't care how much they rake it. I just want to play live on the internet one time so I can show my mama. So there's a decent chance I'll be at Run It Up Reno. So I need some other kind of carrot to convince me to play live poker. And a live stream, I think that'll do it.
I would love to see you on a live stream, even though you would be the least interesting person on there because you wouldn't say shit.
Yeah, I definitely would not. Maybe I would. If the live stream was there, maybe I would take advantage of it, but I don't know.
You'd give a great interview, though. Like, if they would, you know, talk to you off off camera or whatever, you know, you'd be great for that part of it.
Yeah, I'm hoping that I definitely wouldn't be like the guy calling for a round of shots. So I wouldn't be that guy. I'm hoping that my play would be entertaining in some way, a lot more so nowadays than it would have been 2 years ago. 2 years ago, it would have just been the pits. It's like, this guy is not talking. He's not moving. He's got these damn shades. So, and he's a nit. So hopefully, you know, I got some. I know how to check raise post flop now. So, so maybe that'll be entertaining. And like, you know, if I'm doing a good job of paying attention to the other player's tendencies, maybe I can find some good spots to get out of line. And I don't know that. That would be entertaining, but I don't know, man. I can't be responsible for my actions when there's a camera on. So I don't know what I would do.
I think we've definitely got a lot of listeners who would be excited to see you on a live stream.
Yeah, I thought about doing live at the bike, but since I've been on the West Coast, I just kind of like, I don't know. That was like one of the things I was looking forward to when I first moved out here. And then since I've been here, I just haven't done it. I haven't done it. So I guess that means that it wasn't as big of a priority as I thought it would be. But tournaments are more of my thing. So a lot, I would not. And that's why I mentioned the $1,000 sit and go they have in Portland. It's a format that I'm comfortable with. And tournaments fall into that same boat. And so you combine that with the camera, then that would be a big draw for me. With live at the bike, I don't know how comfortable I would be in a cash game, especially one that plays that far outside of correct play. Yeah.
Thanks for pushing through the audio and connection difficulties. I definitely enjoyed speaking to you.
You too. This is fun.
And I guess enjoy the last of your subbing days and safe travels down to San Diego and say hi to Mike for me.
I will.
All right, take care.
Okay. Bye, Andrew.
Devotion of a Carmelite, the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us into law?
Great, is because I was doing it off of my cell phone internet connection. Now I'm on the iPad on the McDonald's connection. So I think this is the best connection we're going to get.
Okay.
But this microphone is not as good as the Snowball mic, but I think it's doable. I don't know what the hang up button is. Okay.